Welcome back to True Crime San Antonio. I am just another San Antonio native, and thank you for tuning in. This week's episode is one that must be told. If you've noticed, my episodes are named after the people who were the victims of these stories. Then you should understand that this week features the victim and his alleged killer, who claimed his innocence and even had one of the victims vindicate him the crime he was executed for. But first, San Antonio True Crimes This Week. A homeowner left suspected would-be cop killers bloodied. Bexar County Sheriff says Anthony Cardenas fought with suspects not knowing they had guns. A homeowner in the far west Bexar County is getting at least some of the credit for helping to stop two men who were accused of shooting at sheriff's deputies. Anthony Cardenas fought with one of the two suspects who broke into his home, who broke in and ran through his home located near Highway 90 and Loop 1604, just after 3 a.m. on Thursday, September the 9th. Unbeknownst to Anthony, those two men were armed and on the run after allegedly breaking into cars in the area and firing shots at two Bexar County Sheriff's deputies. Anthony says, they came in, they got the keys, and basically I'm assuming they were looking for a getaway car. I pulled the door open and we got into a fight inside the truck. We went from the driver's side to the passenger side and we both fell out. After the struggle, Cardenas says the suspects and continued running, taking his keys with them. Deputies soon were able to take him into custody, and Sheriff Salazar says the suspects were slowed down with a bit of street justice. He said the trouble began after they arrived at Baffin Peak to answer calls about car burglaries. Sheriff Salazar says as soon as one of the deputies stepped out of his car, he was met by a barrage of gunfire. Quote, I'm told the only reason the suspect stopped firing is because his weapon ran out of ammo. He ran it dry in an effort to kill this deputy. Two of the bullets struck the deputy's car. The second suspect, meanwhile, fired shots at another deputy who was chasing him. One of those bullets also hit a parked car, but neither deputy was hurt. Ultimately, they arrested both men. It's just luck. It's just by God's grace that we're not talking about two dead deputies, Salazar said, adding that they showed great restraint. These deputies didn't have to fire a single shot to get these two armed, desperate would-be cop killers into custody. Both suspects now face a number of charges, including attempted capital murder. And Cardenas is truly a hero, because think about it, he didn't know that these two had guns. I mean, if they had any bullets left, they would have killed him. If you ask me, it might be just a little bit of divine intervention, like Jules once said. And if you get that reference, we can be friends. Also, a trial could begin for a man accused over committing capital murder over 30 years ago. Investigators say Larry Moore, now 68, had keys to the victim's home at the time of the murder. More than 30 years ago, on January of 1987, a San Antonio woman was found dead inside a bathtub in her home. San Antonio police say it happened on Bailey Avenue, just off Hackberry Street. According to the Bexar County Medical Examiner's Office, Diana Lowry died by asphyxiation. Her death was ruled a homicide. Unfortunately, police were never able to gather enough evidence to arrest the suspect and the case went cold. Years later, it reopened and investigators found that Larry Moore was the owner of both his and Lowry's duplex at the time of the murder. They say Moore had the spare set of keys to Lowry's apartment. It wasn't until 2004 when Lowry's mother called the San Antonio Police Department and told him that she was terminally ill and would like to see justice for her daughter before she died. It was then that a SAPD homicide detective that was assigned to the cold case unit at the time took the matters into her own hands and found enough evidence against Larry Moore. Eventually, he was indicted for the murder on September 19, 2005, but a prosecutor under the previous administration dismissed the case for further investigation on March 15, 2007. In January of 2018, Lowry's niece called the Bexar County District Attorney's Office seeking answers for her aunt's case and why it had been dismissed. Nico LaHood eventually reopened the case again. Upon further investigation, determined there was sufficient evidence to prosecute Larry Moore for capital murder. If convicted, his punishment could either be death or life in prison with the possibility of parole after 40 years. If courts reopen due to having been closed by the pandemic, the trial could begin on December 7, 2021. This is a case that I've been looking into for a long time myself, so I'm very interested to find out what happens. I'll keep y'all updated. All right, I think we're good. Here we go, episode 6. Warning, this story depicts accounts of violence and adult themes that may be found disturbing and unsuitable for some. Listener discretion is advised. Texas executed its fifth teenage offender 22 minutes after midnight on August 24, 1993. Ruben Cantu, 17 at the time of his crime, had no previous convictions, but a San Antonio prosecutor had branded him a violent thief, gang member, and murderer who ruthlessly shot one victim 9 times with a rifle before emptying just as many into the only eyewitness, a man who would barely survive to testify against him. Why am I starting at the end of the story, you might ask? Because the end of Ruben's life was only the beginning of a long thread of lies and corruption, and one might argue that maybe his execution was a crime in itself. Ruben Montoya Cantu was born December 5th, 1966. Ruben was described as an awfully eager to please kid who often watched TV until well after midnight and looked up to his older siblings, as well as being a role model for the younger. His mother married a 37-year-old man when she was only 13. He was the fourth of 5 children born to Arelia and Fidencio Fred Cantu. Arelia raised her boys and daughter mostly alone, while her husband worked long hours as a maintenance man at Market Square, a popular tourist attraction in downtown San Antonio. By the time Ruben turned 14, his mother left her husband and moved 30 miles away to Floresville, a sleepy, mostly Mexican-American town of 5,000, to be near her parents. His mother asked Ruben to come along, but Ruben and his siblings chose to stay with his father and continue to live in the trailer on Briggs Avenue, deep in the crime-ridden South San Antonio barrio, a place where drug dealers, smugglers, fences, and thieves lived and worked in houses pockmarked with bullet holes. But while his father worked, often long hours into the night, Ruben was skipping school and learning different lessons on the street. Ruben's South San Antonio neighborhood was controlled by the Gray Eagles, the street kids who roamed it and relentlessly guarded its boundaries. Though small for his age and slow in school, Ruben became one of its leaders. He began sampling the drugs readily available through the neighborhood dealers and stole cars for joyrides. By the time he turned 15, he was recruited into an auto theft ring. Sometimes he disappeared for days, driving hot cars and pickups to the border and coming back with $2,000 to $3,000 in cash. Surrounded by grinding poverty, Ruben could spend all he wanted on video games, movies, and drugs. He learned quickly to avoid the San Antonio police. A force, in some of its darkest days in the 1980s, was plagued by scandals related to drug dealing officers and vigilantes who took justice into their own hands. A story for another day, perhaps. Ruben grew up believing that no police officer could be trusted. Already a quiet child, he quickly mastered the neighborhood code of silence. You never ratted on anyone, no matter the cost to yourself. Ruben practiced this art to an extreme. His silence, even in a neighborhood known for its secrets, remained a local legend. Neighborhood officers knew and disliked Ruben, and they had arrested his older brothers on drug and theft charges, but they could never successfully pin a crime on Ruben. It was against this backdrop of mutual suspicion that Ruben would soon emerge as the leading suspect after a violent murder and robbery occurred on Briggs Avenue on November the 8th, 1984. That night, at approximately 11:30 p.m., Juan Moreno, a skinny, hard-working teenager who had been in San Antonio a little over a year and came from a Mexican ranch in Zacatecas, was camping out in a house almost directly across the street from Ruben's trailer. Juan Moreno, then 19, and his brother-in-law, Pedro Gomez, 25, had eaten dinner and gone to sleep inside the virtually empty brick house they were helping to build for Juan's brother and his wife. They were guarding it because burglars had recently stolen a water heater, as well as building materials over the weeks. Inside the shell of a house, there was a pair of mattresses on the floor in the front room. The only water was stored in empty beer cans. The only light came from a single 75-watt bulb on a lamp powered by an extension cord connected to the neighbor's house. Both Juan and Pedro worked construction and were paid in cash. That night, they slept in their clothes with wallets containing a total of about $1,000. Juan Moreno would later testify that he was awakened by Ruben Cantu poking him with a .22 caliber rifle, and that he recognized the two men standing before him, seeing them twice before around the neighborhood. They were instructed to sit down on the bed and give them their watches and wallets, and Pedro, the father of three little girls back in Mexico, handed over his wallet with $600 inside. They were then instructed to pull back the mattress, which revealed a .38 caliber revolver wrapped in rags. Before Pedro could grab the pistol, he was shot in the head once and then shot eight more times after he fell, killing him. Then Juan was shot several times in the head, neck, and chest, somehow surviving the shooting. When Juan blacked out from the shots and pain, the pair fled. Juan Moreno somehow managed to survive the attack though. He stumbled out of the house and went to the neighbors for help shortly after that. At 11:58 p.m., a police officer found Juan bleeding on the seat of a pickup truck in front of the house. His wallet and his money were untouched, but he could barely speak. The description he gave of the attackers fit almost all the male teens in the neighborhood, two Mexican-Americans who he thought lived nearby. Homicide Detective James Herring, an officer with 15 years on the force, had only that vague description to work with when he was assigned the case. And Detective Herring, who knew no Spanish, needed others to help him speak with Juan and people from the neighborhood. His first attempt to speak with Juan at Wolford Hall Hospital on Lackland Air Force Base the day after the murder was to no avail, as Juan remained in critical condition and on a breathing machine. He was unable to talk and write because of his massive internal injuries. Eventually, he lost a lung, a kidney, and part of his stomach. In another visit 6 days after the murder, Juan could barely talk, Detective Herring wrote in his report, but he did give the detective a few more details on his attackers. Two Latin American males, one 13 or 14 and the other 19. He said he had seen the younger teen around the neighborhood. It wasn't much. Then a neighborhood beat officer passed along a rumor from the halls of South San Antonio High School, where Ruben was in the 9th grade. A shop teacher reported that three kids had been involved in the robbery and murder of Pedro Gomez, and that students were saying Ruben Cantu had done the killing. Also involved were David Garza and a third named student. Based on that information, Detective Herring and Detective Quintanilla revisited Juan on December 16, 1984. This time, Detective Herring showed Juan photographs of five Hispanic men, including Ruben. Juan, who was still in early recovery stages and dealing with massive amounts of pain from his injuries, showed emotion that the officers interpreted as fear, but did not identify Ruben as his attacker. Police records show that Detective Herring made no more reports on the case. Near the end of the year, he received a promotion and was transferred out of homicide. The Pedro Gomez murder case appeared closed. That all changed a few months later on March 1, 1985. After midnight, Ruben Cantu was shooting 35-cent pool games at the Scarborough Lounge, a fluorescent-lit local hangout about a mile from his father's home. An off-duty police officer who was a stranger to Ruben was playing at another table with his cousin. Officer Joe De La Luz wore two guns under his civilian clothes, according to records. Ruben, too, was armed. Both had been drinking, based on court testimony and interviews. Officer De La Luz later claimed under oath that Ruben shot him four times in a completely unprovoked attack. Quote, "I remember a person standing in front of me and firing an unknown caliber weapon at me." Ruben claimed they argued over a pool game and he fired only after De La Luz showed him a gun in his waistband and threatened him. Ruben never denied to his friends or his family that he shot De La Luz, though he told him he had learned only afterward that De La Luz was a policeman. Ruben, however, was never convicted of shooting the officer, despite a bar full of witnesses and his own admissions. Quote, "There was an overreaction, and some of the evidence may have been tainted. It could not be prosecuted," said former Homicide Sergeant Bill Yule, who oversaw the investigation. Defense attorneys claimed that the police illegally searched Ruben's home on the night of the shooting. But Sergeant Ewell was a friend of Officer De La Luz, the injured officer, and said the attack prompted him to reopen the unsolved Briggs Avenue murder case, in which the only surviving eyewitness had previously failed to identify Ruben. The now-retired Sergeant Ewell was a seasoned senior officer who had recently been promoted to lead the homicide division back then, was quoted in the Houston Chronicle. "Cantu shot an officer who worked with me. It was difficult to get the witness to make the identification. We weren't able to get him for the police shooting, but we were able to get him for the murder. I'm confident the right people were prosecuted." 2 days after the shooting, the same anonymous student who was named with Ruben and David, let's call him King. King would tell investigators that Ruben, a childhood friend, had admitted to him that he was responsible for shooting both men on Briggs Avenue. In December of 1984, he was brought to the police station, where he denied knowing of the murders. He then relented, but was deathly afraid of giving a written statement to the police, as he feared both Cantu brothers, who were claimed to have Mexican mafia ties as well. For 2 months, Juan Moreno, recovering at his brother's home, had received no visits or calls from the San Antonio police. But on March 2, 1985, Sergeant Ewell sent a seasoned bilingual homicide detective to show Ruben Cantu's photo to Juan for the second time. In the kitchen of his brother's house, Juan still did not identify Ruben, though at some point he learned Ruben had shot a police officer. Santos Sam Baleza, the now retired detective, interviewed Juan that day. He said that he had doubted that Juan could have made a reliable identification. It had been dark, he had been afraid for his life, and he had previously declined to identify the suspect. Quote, "It was real tricky to show the same person a photo array more than once. It would look like you were pressuring them." But the next day, Sergeant Ewell consulted with Officer De La Luz, and then sent out a different bilingual detective to show Ruben's photo to Juan for the third time. This time, the detective, Edward Quintanilla, brought Juan, an illegal immigrant, back to the police station, and again showed him Ruben's photo along with four other mugshots. The officer's report indicates that this time Moreno picked out Ruben Cantu, then signed and dated the back of the photo. But the photo submitted into evidence at trial was not dated on the back, according to a trial transcript, nor does Juan recall that anyone translated for him a statement in English that identifies Ruben Cantu as his attacker and bears his signature. Juan Moreno, the surviving victim, was the key witness in this trial, eventually identifying Ruben Cantu as his killer in court. Ruben Cantu was reported to have an IQ of 78, claiming he was innocent of the robbery and killing, and to be in Waco, Texas at the time of the shootings. He even had witnesses on the stand to testify to this, but they weren't believed by the jury. King, the unnamed student, would meet with Investigator Thullen and give a full statement about Ruben Cantu and what he had divulged to him 2 days after the murder. But the very next day, he recanted his statement. Investigator Thullen was suspicious of the sudden action and had King given a polygraph that showed he wasn't present at the scene of the crime, but was deceitful with the knowledge of who did it. The investigators assumed it was because of his fear of the Cantus. Later in July of 1985, King would be shot at by someone in a vehicle he believed to be Robert Cantu's, Ruben's older brother. He also reported that Ruben's dad and another gentleman whom he met downtown offered him money to change his testimony. The prosecution eventually decided not to use King as another witness, in addition to Juan Moreno. Bruce Baxter, the prosecutor who handled Pedro Gomez's murder case, said he could believe that Juan Moreno lied under the circumstances. However, Baxter, now an attorney in Washington State, said he privately interviewed Juan before the trial in 1985 to try and determine whether he had made the ID just to appease the police. At the time, Baxter said he believed Juan was sincere. Baxter's entire case depended on it because there were no confessions, no murder weapon, and no fingerprints for him to use against Ruben Cantu. David Garza was 15 years old then and was arrested as Ruben's accomplice. He had refused to implicate Ruben, even to help himself. What Baxter had was a one-witness case against a teenager. But he also knew, just as the defense attorneys feared, that the word of Juan Moreno, then a 19-year-old who had been badly injured, could sway a jury. In both the pretrial hearing and during the trial, Juan testified over and over that Ruben had shot and killed his friend. In court, Prosecutor Baxter questioned Juan on the stand. "Do you see in the courtroom the man who poked you with a rifle and woke you up?" "Yes." "And where is that person?" "That is Ruben Cantu." "And who shot you?" "Ruben." His emotional testimony was given in Spanish about how he watched his friend get killed and nearly died himself was the key evidence presented against Ruben Cantu during the guilt phase of the July 1985 trial. Defense attorney Andrew Caruthers, an experienced lawyer, though he had never before handled a death case, tried to discredit the identification without attacking Juan, who was a sympathetic witness. Quote, "I'm not saying Juan Moreno is lying. I'm saying that he did not get a look at who shot him. He didn't get a good look at them, and the police tried to substitute their opinion for his," Caruthers argued. "He is now a Bexar County magistrate." In spite of the lack of physical evidence, no confession, and only Juan's testimony, Ruben Cantu was convicted by a jury of first-degree murder. In the punishment phase of the trial, prosecutors presented another star witness, Officer De La Luz, the officer who was shot by Ruben 3 months after the Pedro Gomez murder. Without that bar shooting, prosecutors would have been left to try and argue for death based on street rumors about the young Ruben's gang activities and a pending marijuana possession charge. But De La Luz testified that Ruben had shot him without provocation. It was all the jurors really needed to convince him that Ruben, though still a teenager, was extremely dangerous, a threat to society if you must, and that he should be put to death. Ruben Cantu's attorneys did not want him to testify, and so Ruben, as had been his custom nearly all his life, sat silently before his accusers. He wept only after the prosecutors asked the jury to sentence him to die. Days later, he wrote a letter that he addressed to the citizens of San Antonio. "My name is Ruben M. Cantu, and I am only 18 years old. I got to the 9th grade and I have been framed in a capital murder case. I was framed because I shot an off-duty police officer named Joe De La Luz." For years, defense attorneys who handled Ruben's appeals attacked the reliability of Juan Moreno's identification, insisting that police inappropriately influenced him. On the first round of appeals, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals ruled that the identification process was improperly suggestive, though the court upheld the in-trial identification and didn't overturn Ruben's conviction. Quote, "In the abstract of the process of showing Juan several arrays on different occasions, all containing the appellant's photograph, is a suggestive procedure. Such a procedure tends to highlight a particular defendant since the witness sees the same face repeatedly. Such reoccurrence of one particular face might suggest to the witness that the police think the defendant is the culprit," February 1987 opinion read. None of the defense attorneys who represented Ruben during his appeals ever attempted to find Juan, who they had assumed returned to Mexico. He moved to the other part of San Antonio. Don't know how hard it was to find him. During his 8 years on death row, Ruben repeatedly insisted he was innocent of the murder. In 1987, he wrote to the Board of Pardons and Paroles saying, "I was tried and convicted on bogus evidence." But on August 24, 1993, the final meal for Ruben Cantu included barbecue chicken, refried beans, brown rice, sweet tea, and he asked for boba gum. Gum is not permitted under the Texas Department of Criminal Justice regulations, so he was denied the gum. He finally was strapped to a gurney and readied for lethal injection. Ruben was asked if he had any final words, and he replied, "No, sir." As his attorney watched him die through a special one-way viewing window. 22 minutes after midnight, Ruben Cantu was dead at the age of 26, becoming the fifth teenage offender to be executed by Texas. Outside the prison gate, his mother Aurelia Cantu held a candle in a small crowd of protesters. Quote, "He's resting now, he's free, but he should not have been here in the first place." That night in another Texas prison, his old friend and convicted accomplice David Garza listened to news reports of the execution on a radio in his cell and wept for things left unsaid. Quote, "Part of me died when he died," Garza said in an interview with the Houston Chronicle. "You got a 17-year-old who went to his grave for something he did not do. Texas murdered an innocent person." That same day, at his small home on a street near the railroad tracks in the East Side San Antonio area, a surviving eyewitness got a phone call telling him that the man he accused would soon die. But Juan Moreno, a still scarred robbery victim who barely survived the 1984 attack, felt no relief, just unsettling guilt. He was a surviving victim and the key eyewitness in the trial, eventually identifying Ruben as his killer in court, only to recant his story a decade after Ruben was executed. In 2 decades, his life had morphed from that of a traumatized newly arrived Mexican teenager into that of an independent Texas contractor, husband, and father of a teenager of his own. Juan now insists a Hispanic teen with very curly hair shot him. Police never showed him a photo of that man. He said police never threatened him, but influenced him in subtle ways. Juan said he felt compelled to do what the officers wanted, even though he knew it was wrong. The police were sure it was Ruben because he had hurt a police officer, Juan said in an interview. "They told me they were certain it was him, and that's why I testified. That was bad to blame someone that was not there." In his heart, he always knew that what he was doing was bad, he shared. His wife, Annabelle, who met and married him years after the attack, said that when she asked about his scars, he always told her that the wrong man had been sent to death row for them. Juan did not know Ruben or his family before the time of the murder trial in 1985. In the years after the attack, he had no contact with them or anyone connected with the case. He said he thinks that someone from the Cantu family tried to telephone him around the time of the 1993 execution, but he wasn't home. Juan says he has nothing to gain by talking about the attack. The horror of that night that he watched his friend Pedro die face down in a pool of blood has not left him. He still feels pain from his own injuries. Despite that, he said he is no longer afraid to speak because he wants people to know the truth about Ruben Cantu. "I'm sure it wasn't him," he says. "It was a case where the wrong person was executed." David Garza, Ruben's alleged accomplice, has since admitted involvement in the burglary, assault, and murder of Pedro Gomez and Juan Moreno. He says he did go inside the house, he did participate in the robbery, and he saw the murder take place, but that his accomplice was not Ruben Cantu. Instead, he names King, the unnamed student. In August of 1985, David Garza pled guilty to the lesser offense of robbery and was sentenced to 20 years in the Texas Department of Corrections, and I found a report that he may have only served 6 years for this before being released and was never charged with murder. Last I could find is David Garza is back in prison on an unrelated burglary charge. When David Garza turned the story upside down 15 years after Ruben Cantu's execution, the now former Bexar County District Attorney Susan B. Reed pronounced the disclosures very troubling and vowed a thorough investigation. The result was a 113-page report in 2007. It concluded that Ruben had been in fact guilty. Reed's spokesperson proclaimed the report fair, but the attorney for the surviving victim disagreed, saying, "What we got with the DA's report is not a fair evaluation, but an evaluation with a cloud over it, a cloud created by a fact finder with a significant interest in the outcome." DA Reed was considering charging Juan Moreno with murder by perjury, since his testimony was crucial in obtaining a death sentence against Ruben. But after the report in 2007, nothing came of it. Critics have noted that Reed was formerly a judge who handled Ruben's appeal and set his execution date, raising a conflict of interest in conducting an investigation of his guilt. Moreover, many who were familiar with the case doubt Reed's conclusions and say the report's findings do not add up. Critics of Reed's report say it overstates evidence of Ruben's guilt and glosses over troubling aspects of the case. One claim that has raised doubts about the report's accuracy is a finding that one of Rubin's defense attorneys solicited and obtained a plea deal from the prosecutors, but that the presiding judge in the case rejected the agreement. That judge, Roy Barrera Jr., has maintained that he has no memory of a plea deal, adding, "I don't think Rubin ever considered a plea." Andrew Caruthers, Rubin's lead defense attorney during his trial, said that Rubin refused to plead guilty. He noted that if Barrera had rejected a plea deal, the defense would have ensured it appeared somewhere in the record, which it did not. The report's description of Rubin's jailhouse confession to another inmate has also raised questions. The report claims that while he was awaiting his murder trial, Rubin Cantu confessed to fellow inmate Tom L. Korsmans, who had at least 8 prior felony convictions and was potentially facing a mandatory minimum jail term of 25 years in prison. The report states that the snitch was not offered anything for his testimony against Rubin and that he passed a polygraph test about his story. The report does not mention Korsman's habitual offender status or the fact that the prosecutor lowered his bond and helped him to get out of jail after he told a story about Rubin's alleged confession. Also, his telling of the story had major discrepancies. He claims that Rubin told him he found the rifle in the house with Juan and Pedro, but Juan never mentions another gun in the house, only that Pedro had the .38 revolver, and that the two men were in sleeping bags, and we know now from records that they had mattresses. Let me play devil's advocate here for a bit. You see, there are many people who claimed Rubin not only claimed to have committed the murder, but bragged about it. It may be difficult for some to understand why a person would admit his involvement in a capital murder. To understand why Rubin might have done this, you have to understand the kind of person he was and the world he lived in. One of his teachers, who had known him since he was in elementary school and knew his brothers, said that Rubin came from a dysfunctional home. The vice principal of his high school recalled that Rubin was a problem and had been disciplined for fighting. According to the vice principal, Rubin always felt that he had an image to maintain, as he was a member of a neighborhood gang called the Gray Eagles. One of Cantu's friends and alleged witness to his alibi similarly describes him. According to this friend, Cantu was a small and skinny kid, but he didn't take any shit from anybody. He was a wild kid. Rubin was known to carry a 9mm or 25 caliber automatic weapon with him and liked to brag about the people that he shot. He would pull his gun on anyone who disagreed with him and would not hesitate to shoot someone at the drop of a hat. Additionally, King, the now alleged shooter, per David, said that when Cantu became intoxicated, whether from alcohol or other drugs, he became overbearing and pushy. Rubin worked hard to cultivate his reputation, and it was clear that people were afraid of him. Based on his actions, it's not hard to believe that Rubin must have thought that no one would ever turn him in for a crime. A woman who lived in the neighborhood had heard about Cantu breaking into other homes on Briggs Avenue. According to her, the owner of the house where the murder had occurred had came over to her dad's house before the murder and was complaining about the Cantus breaking into his home. He was complaining to her dad that he could not get the house finished because they were taking all the materials. He told her dad that no one in the neighborhood would turn the Cantus in because they were scared to death. In addition, Cantu had already been charged and tried for attempted murder in March of 1984, just 8 months before the murder of Pedro Gomez. Although the victim had given a sworn statement to police detailing Cantu's crime, at trial he recanted and Rubin was acquitted. Rubin was also implicated in other homicide shootings and assaults, but witnesses would not identify him because they were scared. It was hard to imagine how this would not have emboldened him. Given the uniformity of Rubin's private statements and actions around those he knew and trusted, it makes for very strong evidence of his guilt. There are other problems with David Garza's statements that considerably undermine his credibility. David claims that on November 8, 1984, the day of the murders, he went to Rubin's house and was told by Rubin's father, Fidencio, that Rubin was out of town. Fidencio not only cast doubt on the claim that Rubin was out of town that night, he completely contradicts David's version. You see, Fidencio was in Corpus Christi the night of the murder, and the incidents couldn't have happened as David now contends. Prior to Rubin's trial, There were discussions between the lead prosecutor and David Garza's defense lawyer about the possibility of him testifying against Ruben. Although he did not believe David's testimony was desperately needed, the prosecutor felt that he could corroborate Juan Moreno. Ultimately, David was not willing to testify. The reason given was not that Ruben was innocent, but rather, the reason was David's fear of Ruben. The lead prosecutor explained what happened. As we were calling back and forth during this time period, Mr. Rodriguez gave me reason to think that David Garza might be available. However, Mr. Rodriguez called and told me that before jury selection was about to start, that David wasn't willing to testify. David had also told his lawyer that Ruben was a trustee at the Bexar County Jail and was serving him his food. With Ruben looking across the counter serving his food every day, David realized that Ruben could get to him at any time. I don't bring any of this up for any other reason than to be fair to the story. Do I feel like Ruben deserved to die for a crime you can arguably agree that there was a lot of questions left unanswered or proved without a doubt? No. But can you still call him innocent? Not really. Sam Millsap feels the same. He was the Bexar County District Attorney whose office charged Ruben with capital murder. He still gets emotional when he talks about the realization that Ruben Cantu, a former special education student convicted of murder, was likely innocent when he was executed by the state in 1993. He now advocates for the abolishment of the death penalty. Quote, "I made a mistake. Ruben Cantu should not have been prosecuted for capital murder. You have to make sure you're getting it right. Testimony of a single eyewitness is not enough. It's so questionable. There's so many places where it could break down. We have a system that permits people to be convicted based on evidence that could be wrong because it's mistaken or because it's corrupt." He has to live with the guilt invoked by his participation in Ruben's fate. I don't know about you, but I was angry learning about the fact that this kid was put to death based on one eyewitness account. Angrier to learn that both David and Juan knew they could have stopped it. Mad about the fact that the detective may have taken and twisted a story to fit their end. There's plenty of accounts that the Cantu brothers intimidated anyone who crossed them, and in Ruben's first murder case, the witness recanted just before the trial. Coincidence? Maybe. Today, if you're accused of something, we as a society have taken to the victim more than we did 30 years ago, especially if there's more than one incident. In Ruben's case, there were at least three: the acquittal, the bar shooting, and then Pedro's murder, even if he didn't do that one. It's easy to show that this kid was dangerous and very much capable of murder. He deserved to be in prison, but he didn't deserve to die for Pedro's murder, based on what they could prove. I know what you're thinking. We're coming to the end of the story, and you're like, what about King? You're telling me that now he could be the shooter, and he's just going to get away with it? I'll put it this way. I looked him up. He has no convictions. He's not been to prison, as far as I can tell. And as far as this case is concerned, they already have their person arrested, convicted, and executed. There's no reason for them to open it or do anything at all. Maybe he was a shooter, maybe he wasn't. Maybe he realized he got away with murder and said he'd never do it again, hopefully changing his life for the better. Or he's just another victim in this. There's no way to truly know. The tragedy in all this: Pedro Gomez was 25. He barely lived, and his three little girls had to grow up without their dad. And if the claims of innocence are to be believed, that means his killer is possibly still out there, never having to face the consequences of his actions on that fateful night. At least not to us, anyway. So that's our story. Let me know your thoughts on Instagram at True Crime San Antonio. Thanks for tuning in. This has been True Crime San Antonio, and I am just another San Antonio native, hoping to see us through. Take care.